February 6th will mark 100 years since the birth of one of the most popular presidents in American history, Ronald Reagan. His story's been told by several biographers, but none quite in the way that his son, Ron, tells it. Ron Reagan's written a new memoir about his dad and their relationship. It's called My Father at 100.
It wasn't that I had in mind some particular thing that I wanted to say about him that I felt other people hadn't said. What I was really looking for was keys to his character and personality, particularly the inner character, the metaphorical 10% that I talk about in the book that he rarely let anybody see, even his own family, even his own wife, that the keys to that character would be found in his early life. And so I went hunting around in those early days.
What was your dad's relationship like with his past? I mean, you went back to Tampico. You went back to Dixon, Illinois. You drove through that part of the country where he grew up and then left, of course, to Hollywood in his youth. Did he kind of want to put that behind him or recreate it, or did he embrace it?
Well, all of those things, in a way. He certainly embraced it. He did like to, as I point out in the book, and in some instances, he does a little script editing. You know, he will relate stories from his past, but he will eliminate uncomfortable aspects. The story of him when he was on his college football team, pulled into a hotel. There are two black players on the team, and they learn that the black players won't be welcome to stay in the hotel. Coach says, you know, fine, we'll sleep on the bus. And my father intervenes and convinces him to send his two black friends home with him. And that way the team can sleep in a hotel and be comfortable, and the black players won't feel like they're the cause of, you know, us all shivering on a bus all night. He would not, when he would relate the story to me in later, much later years, admit that it was Dixon that was the town where this hotel wouldn't take black people.
Wow.
And that no other hotel in the town would accept black people. Now, he refers to racism in his autobiography as these tumors of racism within the country. Well, that poses a problem for him. Is Dixon a tumor? Is Dixon an ugly aberration in the country? Or, on the other hand, is the country, even North, even in the land of Lincoln, systemically racist, which makes it a little tough to see it as a kind of amber-tinged, you know, shining city on a hill. So he was kind of stuck in a catch-22 there and, you know, made some editing cuts there to try and paper that over, I think.
Ron Reagan, I'm sure you've had a variation of this question over the course of your life, but given that you're so publicly associated with, let's say, progressive politics today, how do you sort of deal or respond to questions about the fact that you are the son of this conservative icon? I mean, the most important, arguably, conservative icon.
Well, you see him as a conservative icon, of course. I see him as my father. Most people see him as the former president of the United States, which, of course, I grant you, I recognize also. But to me, he's my father. And fathers and sons, parents and children have been arguing over politics and disagreeing over politics for as long as there have been parents, children, and politics.
Did you ever upset him with sort of being frank about your views on an issue?
He was difficult to upset, and he certainly didn't get upset just because you happened to disagree with him. Now, he did think that if he could get you alone for 5 or 10 minutes, that he could convince you of his point of view. I imagine he found it a bit frustrating that over the years that didn't seem to work with me all the time. But that wasn't something that I was going to particularly you know, bother about in the book. I did not want this book to be a political book. I wasn't out to settle scores with him in any way. I argued with him plenty when he was alive, and we could do it face to face. I had no intention of picking a fight with him where he wouldn't be able to defend himself.
You intersperse bits of your dad's biography with recollections of your relationship with him. And at one point he said to you, and I love this quote, he said, "You're my son, so I have to love you, but sometimes you make it very hard to like you."
Yes.
do you remember what he was responding to?
I don't remember exactly what it was, no. I mean, we would get, you know, of course, we'd have difficulties. I was a teenager at that time. I was probably 16, 17
years
old.
You grew your hair long, and you were the son of Ronald Reagan.
Oh, sure. I wore thrift store clothes and military surplus, was against the Vietnam War, and I was an atheist, and, you know, all sorts of listened to music that he couldn't understand, and, you know, strange smells would emerge from my bedroom occasionally, and all that sort of thing. So, you know, yeah, he wasn't happy about that. But again, that's, I think, a sentiment that a lot of parents may feel about their teenage children. It can, you know, the teenage years can be a bit rocky.
I'm curious to know what you make of the sort of veneration of Ronald Reagan. You call it a fetish in the book. And I want to play a clip of some of what that might sound like.
Okay. All right.
Who is your favorite Republican president?
Ronald Reagan.
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 Reagan. He brought me into the Republican Party.
I'm proud to have been a member of the Reagan Revolution
and the Reagan principles.
Aside from President Reagan, who is your political hero?
Right. This is a trick question. Yeah. Hang on.
Everybody loves Ronald Reagan.
I mean, everybody loves Ronald Reagan.
Does it make you uncomfortable, or do you sort of distance yourself from that?
It doesn't make me uncomfortable. I understand it. I mean, if you're a Republican candidate for president or any other office for that matter, who are you going to venerate in the Republican Party? George W. Bush? No, I don't think so. H.W. Bush? Not so inspiring. Nixon? No, that's not going to work for you. You know, Ronald Reagan's pretty much it.
But nonetheless, you call it a fetish.
Well, I think, as you just demonstrated, it becomes so reflexive and so almost fetishistic that really he's like the rubber bustier of the Republican Party. I mean, they're so all over him.
Ron Reagan, in many ways, this book that you've written seems to be about a son getting to know a part of his father that he really didn't know. You know, the Ronald Reagan behind the Edmund Morris biography, Dutch.
By the way, it's much easier to write a history of your father if Pulitzer Prize-winning biographers paved the way for you and left just reams of footnotes for you to go through.
At the end of your journey, what did you discover about your dad that maybe changed the way you think about him or surprised you?
I don't think there were any huge surprises or things that fundamentally changed the way I thought about him. But it is true that I have a new and I hope deeper appreciation for the solitary, undersized little boy that he was, who spent a lot of time by himself, you know, poring over books and strange artifacts, some of them from the West, which, you know, filled his head with visions of this wide open frontier and this broad landscape in which he could be a hero, the guy who saves the day. I think I have a better appreciation of that.
That's Ron Reagan. He's the son of the late President Ronald Reagan. His new book is called My Father at 100. It's in bookstores now. Ron Reagan, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Guy, thanks for having me.
Football, winter, Chicago, Pittsburgh. Four words that go well together. Later today, the Chicago Bears will play host to the Green Bay Packers in football's longest-running rivalry. The Steelers play host to the New York Jets. It's the NFL Conference Finals, and the winners go on to play in Super Bowl 45. NPR's Mike Pesca is as geared up as anyone. So, Mike, you got your face paint and your big foam finger?
Yes, four foam fingers with four number ones because I don't want to tip my hand, literally, I guess, in this case. I know that there have been a lot of conversations about these games, but what I thought we'd do here is maybe look at them in a different way, if that's all right with you, and let you want to talk about who has gap responsibility in the 4-3 set.
Well, if I knew what gap responsibility and whatever that meant, we could talk about it, but I'd rather hear what you have to say, so take it.
Well, all the games come down to the mics. Each team, as it turns out, has a key mic, a person named Mike, in a decision-making position, and the choices that those mics make could decide the games.
Now, two of the head coaches are named Mike.
Yes, and let's start with the Packers head coach, Mike McCarthy. beyond being the head coach, he also calls all the plays for the Packers offense. And they have a great offense. Aaron Rodgers is their quarterback. There is a school of thought that says Aaron Rodgers, because he is so young and so promising, might actually be, over the next decade, the best quarterback in the NFL. A lot of that comes down to McCarthy's play calling. And against the Bears' defense, which is a very good defense, he's going to have to be a little more creative than he has been in the past, because as good as the tools that McCarthy has on offense are, they haven't scored a lot of points against the Bears.
And who's the Chicago Mike in question?
The Chicago Mike is the Bears' offensive coordinator, Mike Martz. Mike Martz was the architect of those great St. Louis Rams teams. They were called the greatest show on turf. The feeling was he loves to throw the ball around the field, aerial assaults and so forth. And he came to Chicago and people said, well, is he going to be able to graft that sort of offense, which was played in a dome and not at the swampy and often wet and windy Chicago field? And Mike Martz has shown that he's just simply a very smart guy. He didn't transfer it wholesale. He worked with Chicago's offense and the tools they had in place. The downfall of the Bears offense for a long time was their offensive line. But luckily, their offensive line coach, whose name happens to be Mike Tice, has gotten their line in order. So this game will have two kind of genius play callers, both named Mike, against each other.
What about the Jets?
Jets have a defensive coordinator named Mike Pettine. Jets head coach Rex Ryan works with his defensive coordinator, Mike Pettine, in a way that no other head coach and no other defensive coordinator works. Usually in the NFL, either a coach will call the defensive plays or the coordinator will call the defensive plays. But Ryan and Pettine collaborate. And it's not written down or decided beforehand how they're going to collaborate. Sometimes they would debate and yell at each other so much, but eventually the plays would be called correctly. And the defensive play calling, the defensive alignment, how smart the Jets have been on defense, has absolutely been the key to their march through the playoffs thus far.
And then there's the Steelers head coach, Mike Tomlin.
This is cheating a little bit because, unlike all the other Mikes we've talked about, Tomlin is not involved in calling specific plays at specific times. But he is a really good and, I think, underrated coach. But how he inspires his team and if he gets them up to play and get revenge on the Jets, because the Steelers had lost to the Jets a couple weeks earlier, that, of course, is going to be a key.
And because it's all about the Mikes, NPR's Mike Pesca. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, that was a little self-serving of me, huh? But you are welcome.
The writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is the best-selling author of Purple Hibiscus and Half of a Yellow Sun, and she's also judging our current round of 3-Minute Fiction here on Weekends on All Things Considered. And we're here to remind you that today is the last day to get your stories in this round. We're asking for original short fiction that can be read in under 3 minutes, so no more than 600 words. But Chimamanda, what's the catch?
Well, Guy, this round we're all about emotions. So at some point in the story, one of the characters must tell a joke. Also, one of the characters must cry.
And to clarify, the joke and crying can be done by the same character or by different characters as long as both happen in the story. And as usual, we have to stick to the deadline.
So you have to get your stories in by 11:59 Eastern Time.
That's 11:59 p.m. tonight. Remember, Eastern Time. To read the full rules and to submit your story, go to our website, npr.org/3-Minute Fiction. That's 3-Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces.
The Federal Communications Commission approved Comcast's merger with NBC Universal this past week, but that approval came with conditions. The deal creates a media giant that will control much of what viewers watch and the way they access it, including many of the shows on television and the cable that delivers them to viewers. The new company will connect millions of homes to the internet and control one of Hollywood's biggest movie studios. In other words, if you watch, download, subscribe, or buy a ticket, you may be doing business with the new merged company. Joe Flint has been covering the story for the Los Angeles Times, and he joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
How big a deal is this?
It's a very big deal. Basically, it is combining the nation's largest distribution company, Comcast, which has over 22 million cable subscribers, another 16, 17 million broadband subscribers, with NBC Universal, which owns, of course, NBC, Universal Pictures, cable networks such as USA, Bravo, CNBC, Sci-Fi. It's the first really big I hate to sound cliched, but 21st century media merger, and the combination of distribution and content is what has so many people concerned about it.
Now, there were no clear antitrust issues. NBC Universal and Comcast operate in different markets. But the FCC was very concerned about this. Why?
Both the FCC and Justice Department really scrutinized this deal. And as you note, there were on the surface no anti-competitive issues. But even though on paper there weren't any rules to violate, just the sheer magnitude of the merger and lumping together content and distribution caused a lot of concern, specifically when it comes to new areas such as online video. Comcast is primarily a cable operator, and the government wants to make sure that Comcast, armed with all this new content, doesn't do anything to stifle the growth of what will likely be the biggest competition to cable, online video.
Now, to get the deal through, the companies had to make a lot of promises about how they would do business. I mean, what did they agree to do, and what does it mean for the average television viewer or consumer?
There were two elements to the deal, and one had to do with the public interest aspects to it. And in that case, Comcast was offering to do more children's programming, more programming aimed at minorities. They agreed to add a Hispanic board member. They did a lot of outreach to different communities to try to get sort of backing. A lot of that, a cynic might say, is a little bit of window dressing, because the real issues here for consumers and for the media industry is what Comcast will do with all this new power they have. And on that note, basically, the FCC and Justice Department laid down conditions that they hope will make it very difficult for Comcast to, one, withhold their own content from competing distribution services, and two, not carry rival programming on their own distribution services. In the online world, basically, if there's an online video competitor that is able to get programming from, say, a Disney or a Warner Brothers or a News Corp, then Comcast would have to do a similar deal with that company. Those are the sorts of conditions that the government put in that they hope will stop Comcast from any plans it might have of stifling the growth of online video and new distribution platforms.
Let's talk just a little bit about money. Will consumers still be able to get, just internet service at a reasonable price?
Yes, one of the conditions actually of the deal is that Comcast has to sell its internet service to consumers who just want that and maybe don't want a cable box. All of that will be in place. What the interesting part for consumers, and we won't know until a few years down the road, is just how effective these conditions will be in not limiting the development of online video. One of the great concerns of the cable industry is consumers dropping their cable subscription and just keeping a broadband connection, figuring they can get all their entertainment that way. And that's something that we'll see play out in the next 3 to 5 years, whether these conditions were tough enough to encourage growth of the online video marketplace.
Joe Flint of the Los Angeles Times, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. We find out this week if Oscar will friend The Social Network, if The Fighter could be a contender, and whether or not Toy Story 3 will prove to be more than just kids' stuff. On Tuesday morning, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences will announce the nominees for the 83rd Academy Awards. Movie critics and film buffs have their shortlists and predictions already. Wesley Morris is film critic at the Boston Globe. He's at member station KPCW in Park City, Utah. Welcome to the program, Wesley.
Thank you, Leanne.
I know you're there for the Sundance Festival, seeing the new crop of pictures, but I want to go back, obviously, to 2010 and Best Picture category. Which films do you think have the best chances of being nominated?
I think 9 of these movies are fairly certain. Black Swan, The Kids Are All Right, The Social Network, The Town, Toy Story 3, The King's Speech, Winter's Bone, The Fighter, Inception, and True Grit. One of those may not make the cut. It might be The Town. It might be Winter's Bone, which means that 127 Hours, the movie in which James Franco's arm gets caught by a boulder, mm-hmm. could make the cut. Or Shutter Island, which was very popular and directed by a popular member of the Academy, Martin Scorsese. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see what actually the 10 movies turn out to be.
Well, this is the second year there will be 10 nominations in that category instead of 5. I mean, what do you actually learn from knowing those extra 5 movies that are up for consideration?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, when the Academy used to do this many years ago, I feel like it told a really interesting story of what the Academy liked and not just what we've been trained to think of as Academy Award movies. And I really like the idea of knowing what those bottom 5 movies are. I mean, last year, District 9 and The Blind Side and An Education, I don't think that those 3 movies would have been one of the 5 nominees if they'd kept the old system, but it really gave you a sense of what movies the people who make our movies like. And that's really interesting.
Black Swan also did quite well at the Golden Globes, garnering a Best Actress win for Natalie Portman, who plays a ballerina on the edge of sanity.
All the discipline for what?
Just want to be perfect.
You what?
Want to be perfect.
Chances that she'll get a nomination for Best Actress. Others?
Annette Bening, who's likely going to win for The Kids Are All Right. I mean, I think she was better in a different movie called Mother and Child, but I mean, I'm in a minority on that movie being as good as it is. Annette Bening's your likely winner. I mean, Natalie Portman could also win, and I think the other 3 women will probably be Nicole Kidman
for The Rabbit Hole,
a film called Rabbit Hole. Jennifer Lawrence for Winter's Bone, who plays a girl looking for her father. She's very good in that. And your 5th nominee, it's going to be a crapshoot.
What about the 14-year-old Haley Steinfeld? Long shot for True Grit?
It'll be interesting to see what happens to her because she's being campaigned for as a supporting actress to better her odds at a nomination. But she also has a shot at a Best Actress nomination because people have watched the movie and said she's in just about every scene. Who is she supporting?
You have misjudged me if you think I'm silly enough to give you $50 and watch you simply write off.
I'm a bonded U.S. Marshal.
That weighs but little with me. I will see the thing done.
So, I mean, you know, those are politics, and it'll be interesting to see because, you know, as a voter, you can put her in either category. And so it'll come down to which category did she get more votes in and whether having it be unclear what her function is in the movie splits the votes in both departments and she gets nothing.
So what was your favorite picture of 2010?
This year, I kind of begged to make a list of 10 movies and without ranking them, and several of the possible Best Picture nominees are among them. But I also really like Jackass 3D, which is nowhere near close to being a Best Picture nominee. Leanne, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
It's really good. I also like Mother and Child, that movie I mentioned before with Annette Bening and Kerry Washington and Naomi Watts. After The Fighter, that's the best acting across the board in a motion picture I saw last year. And Inside Job, a documentary about the financial crisis last year was one of the best years I can think of for nonfiction filmmaking. And I think that'll show up in the nominees. But I mean, forget the Oscars. I think that nonfiction films and documentary filmmaking is as strong in America as it ever has been. And many of the movies I saw last year, like a wonderful film called Sweetgrass about a bunch of sheep being herded for their last pasture, basically, up in Montana. It's a beautiful, very moving, shrewdly well-made movie, and has no shot at an Oscar for Best Picture, but I really loved it. And, you know, one of the things about movies is we all have our favorites, and there are people in the Academy who will have favorites that won't be nominated either. But it's interesting how these 10 movies can really start a conversation about what our movie-going year was like.
Boston Globe film critic Wesley Morris joined us from member station KPCW in Park City, Utah. Thank you, Wesley.
Thank you.